From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Bill Moyers turns 70 next month. He says he will leave his weekly PBS program, Now with Bill Moyers, after the presidential election. He hopes to write a book about President Johnson. On today's Fresh Air, a conversation with Bill Moyers about the media, the divisive political climate, and his experiences working as LBJ's press secretary as the war in Vietnam was escalating. Moyers has a new book called Moyers on America. Also, some are calling what took place in the Abu Ghraib prison abuse. Others are calling it torture. It's even been compared to a hazing. Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers why we don't really have a good word for what went on there. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Carol Van Dam. Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld made a brief surprise visit to Iraq today. Rumsfeld spent part of his seven-hour visit touring the Abu Ghraib prison, the site of abuse by U.S. soldiers of Iraqi prisoners. On the trip over to Baghdad, Rumsfeld told reporters he's taking a long view on the impact of the abuse.
The way to gauge this is not today and not yesterday and not tomorrow, but over time. I mean, we'll know more. More bad things will come out, unquestionably. And time will settle over this, and we'll be able to make an assessment of what the effect has been. It clearly has not been helpful. It has been unhelpful.
Rumsfeld said those who carried out the abuse will be brought to justice. Major General Jeffrey Miller, the man who runs the Iraqi prison system, says the U.S.-run portion of Abu Ghraib will soon be moved entirely outside into tents. In his first appearance on Capitol Hill since the Abu Ghraib prison scandal broke, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz faced tough questions today from the Senate Armed Services Committee on the Pentagon's approved interrogation techniques in Iraq. NPR's David Wellna reports from the Capitol.
Wolfowitz told the Senate panel he had not known of the list of interrogation techniques allowed by the U.S. in Iraq. Rhode Island Democrat Jack Reed asked him about one approved technique.
And that's what this says, a bag over your head for 72 hours? Is that humane?
Let me come back to what you said, the work of the
department. No, answer the question, Secretary. Is that humane?
I don't know whether it means a bag over your head for 72 hours, Senator. I don't know.
Mr. Secretary, you're dissembling, non-responsive. Anybody would say putting a bag over someone's head for 72 hours, which is
sensory
deprivation.
Strikes me as not humane, Senator.
Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary.
Wolfowitz told the panel it would seem the Geneva Conventions are being violated in Iraq. David Wellna, NPR News, the Capitol.
The Pentagon has issued a report indicating that sexual assault in the military has decreased significantly since the mid-1990s. Dr. David Chu is the Undersecretary of Defense for Personnel. He says the rate of sexual assault in the military has decreased 50% in the last 7 years.
The rate in the mid-1990s, remember correctly, was 6-7%. That's against the question in the last year. It's important to time frame here because some of the data you see are lifetime data, some are, you know, in the last month kind of data. In the last year, did any of these things happen to you? Is about 3%, 3-4%, so approximately cut in half.
Chu says sensitivity training for commanders is ongoing. He says the report was commissioned by Secretary Rumsfeld. On Wall Street, the Dow Industrials lost 34 points to close at 10,010 in active trading. The Nasdaq gained a fraction to close at 1,926. The S&P 500 lost a fraction to close at 10,096. This is NPR. A CIA official says voice analysis indicates militant leader Abu Musab el-Zarqawi was most likely the man who was seen beheading Nick Berg on a videotape. Meanwhile, Berg's family has been speaking to reporters. They've shown emails from a U.S. consular official in early April that say Berg was being held by the U.S. military. The military had said he was being held by Iraqis. The amount of ozone in the atmosphere over the southern Atlantic Ocean has increased. Scientists believe much of the increase is from Africa. NPR's Christopher Joyce has this report.
German scientists studied air samples taken during 79 cruises by research vessels in the Atlantic. They found that over the past 25 years, the amount of nitrogen oxides being produced in Africa has increased. These nitrogen oxides, or NOx as they're known, react in the atmosphere to make ozone, one of the ingredients in smog. About four-fifths of the NOx in the world's atmosphere comes from industry and autos in the U.S., Europe, and Asia. Much of what comes from Africa is from lightning or from burning vegetation, but the portion that comes from burning fossil fuels, such as coal or oil, has doubled over the past 2.5 decades, the researchers say. Their report is published in this week's issue of the journal Science. Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Sonia Gandhi, the Italian-born widow of the former Indian Prime Minister Rajiv Gandhi, is poised to become the new Prime Minister of India. Atal Bihari Vajpayee has resigned as Prime Minister. Millions of impoverished Indians who have not been part of the economic boom in their country voted Vajpayee out of office. Gandhi's 34-year-old son Rahul also won a parliament seat in the general elections. I'm Carol Van Dam, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Novo Nordisk, working to improve diabetes treatment in the U.S. For 80 years, diabetes care has been our passion, not just our business.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest Bill Moyers said earlier this year that he intends to step down as host of the weekly PBS series Now with Bill Moyers. He'll remain on the show through the presidential election. Moyers, who turns 70 next month, says it's not that he's feeling old, but there are things he wants to do that are difficult to do while hosting a weekly show. One of those things is writing a book about President Lyndon Johnson, under whom Moyers served as special assistant and press secretary. During Moyers' long career in broadcasting, he's won more than 30 Emmy Awards as well as 9 Peabodys. Moyers has a new book collecting his speeches and commentaries called Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Times. We're living in very polarized times now, but when you were in your early years as a journalist, the times were pretty polarized too. I mean, like in the 60s when you were working, it was a very polarized period. There was the people who supported and the people who opposed the war in Vietnam. There was a big cultural divide in the United States. I'm wondering if you feel like we're in a more polarized time than you can remember, or if the polarization feels very different than it did to you, say, in the 60s when the country was very divided then.
I don't think there's any golden period of American history. America's been a polarized nation from the beginning, Terry. One-third of the people in the colonies fought for the revolution, one-third stood with the British crown, and one-third waited on the sidelines to make money from whatever the outcome was to be. Look how polarized we were in the Civil War, how slavery polarizes, how the McCarthy years, the Red Scare years. I think probably the period of the 40s was the most unified time in American history that I know of or have read about, because we had a common enemy and a war we were fighting. But soon after that, there we went at each other again over who lost China, who's a communist, who's not a communist. And then the 60s hit us with their destabilizing fragmentation, with everything tied down seemed to be coming loose. We are more polarized today, I think, in an ideological sense than we have been at any time in my life. There were a lot of forces at work in the 60s. Today, it's left versus right, or liberals versus conservatives. And the vital center of which Arthur Schlesinger wrote about some 50 years ago has dissolved, disappeared. And that is troubling to me. But I don't think it's worse than it was.
I want to quote something that you wrote for a speech after President Bush was elected, and you were writing that the Eisenhower type of Republican, conservative by temperament and moderate in the use of power, is gone, replaced by zealous ideologues, and for the first time in memory of anyone alive, the entire federal government, the Congress, the executive, the judiciary, is united behind a right-wing agenda. How has that opinion of the Congress and the judiciary and the Bush administration, you know, being represented by a lot of ideologues, how does that opinion affect your approach as a journalist in terms of what is fair and what is balanced in the presentation of issues on a program?
Well, it was a prescient truth, by the way. It created quite a reaction when I said that, for the first time in anyone's lifetime alive today, we have a common ideology that's governing the three branches of government, and it would lead to certain things: a redistribution of wealth, assaults on the environment, the corporatization of government, and all of those analyses proved to be true. It is true that the Democratic Party once held hegemony over the government, controlled the White House, controlled the Congress controlled the judiciary. That wasn't good either for the balance of power in this country, but Democrats always included a lot of liberals, a lot of conservatives, a lot of people who went with the play of the moment. This new ideological governance that we have is uniform in its outlook. It's self-protective. It has an echo chamber. So it is much harder to be a mainstream journalist today than I think it has been in a long time.
Well, do you feel an obligation to have on some of the people who you think are zealots and ideologues?
You know, I'm an old-fashioned liberal when it comes to being open and being interested in other people's ideas. I really do think, and I know this is old-fashioned, that democracy is a conversation, that we should be talking, debating, arguing about who we are, but that we should and what we want, but that but we should listen to each other. And I did the very first interview in 1980 with the leaders of the religious right, Paul Ryrick and John Lofton and Howard Phillips. I put the senator from Utah, Orrin Hatch, I gave him his first interview on television after he was elected. I believe in listening to other people. So I have conservatives on. I led my show last week with Paul Gigot, who is the editor of the Wall Street Journal's editorial page, perhaps the most powerful editorial page in America. Not because I felt obliged to have a conservative on, but because that morning he had run an editorial, very powerful editorial, saying Donald Rumsfeld should not resign. I wanted to talk to him about that. I believe in the mixture of voices, and I do that because that's a conviction with me, not because I feel obliged to do so.
You said you think that this is a difficult time to be a mainstream reporter. Do you think the meaning of mainstream has changed, and do you think that there are certain points of view that earlier in your journalistic career were considered extreme but are now considered mainstream?
Yes, I do. I think, for just take for example, the fact that government policy should reflect religious values is new. The fact that we have faith-based initiatives which are taking federal dollars and putting them behind religious organizations that do not have to follow general rules and guidelines of government policy. Yeah, I think the intrusion of religion as a force in the policies of government, as opposed to being a moral agent operating on politics from outside, like Martin Luther King bringing his moral conscience to bear on the government in the civil rights movement, I think that is new. That sense of government as the enemy is foreign to me, because I was a child of the Depression, a child of the New Deal, and I really believe in public action for the public good. I believe in public resources that should not be privatized. All of that is radical to me. It's foreign to me.
Do you feel like you saw this coming, the shifting of what mainstream means?
I saw it coming because I experienced it in the campaign of 1960, when I was a young aide to Lyndon Johnson, and we were walking across the street from the Waldorf to the Baker Hotel in downtown Dallas, Texas, and suddenly we were confronted with a mob of howling women, women in red, white, and blue uniforms with little hats on their head. Their faces were wreathed in fury. Their eyes were brimming with fire. Their fists were raised in the air. They were led by a right-wing congressman from Dallas named Bruce Alger. These were housewives, and he had harnessed and loosed them to surround Lyndon and Lady Bird Johnson, and I happened to be there as just a sort of aide. And it took us a long time to cross that street. The women spat at the Senator Johnson and spat on Mrs. Johnson. It was a shake. We were shaken. We went up to the room in the hotel across the street and could not believe what we had just experienced. Lyndon Johnson, shrewd politician that he was, thought it was probably going to turn the election in Kennedy and Johnson's favor. But Mrs. Johnson and I both sat for a moment and realized what had unleashed these anger in these women. We hadn't experienced anything like that. It was the first time I had seen what can happen when ideologues become ferocious in their anathema toward the other person. And so I was aware of that for time to come, and then I saw it beginning to unfold with the rise of the religious right in particular, because to be furious in religion, Terry, is to be furiously irreligious. And I could see that happening. I could see it infecting politics with that righteous indignation that transforms politics from compromise into conquest.
Are you comfortable giving opinions or, you know, small editorials on your program?
I am very comfortable reaching conclusions based upon reporting and evidence. I believe in connecting the dots. And I'm very comfortable doing that. Opinion making, mongering? No, I'm not comfortable with that. I'm really not. My opinion is no better than anyone else's. But my informed judgment, based upon the reporting we've done, the investigations we have done, the analysis we have done, and the evidence, and that's, I'm very comfortable being an analyst and drawing conclusions based upon credible research, evidence, documentation, and analysis.
Now, critics of public television say that it is part of the, quote, elite liberal media. And I'm wondering what you hear when you hear the words elite and liberal paired with media.
Well, first I want to know who's saying it and why they're saying it. Is Rush Limbaugh saying that? Is it an adversary of public broadcasting, somebody who wants to bring public broadcasting down? I don't get that from the taxi drivers who brought me here today and said with relish in his voice that his children watch public television, he watches public television, he had NPR on. I don't get that. I get it from the enemies of public television, but I don't get it from the people who watch and listen to us. To the contrary, I think that public television and public radio enjoys a following out there of people who would not have information available to them otherwise. I don't consider myself an elitist. I'm from Marshall, Texas. My father had a fourth grade education. My mother an eighth grade education. I've been fortunate through the years to gain a position in life from which to see a lot of things that I then feel obliged to report to my viewers. And the fact of the matter is, I think the greatest travesty happening in America right now is the hollowing out of the middle class and the exploitation of the working class. And I think it's easy for the class warriors at the top to dismiss that kind of reporting and that kind of journalism by calling it elite popular opinion. I think that's bull, frankly.
Well, what about the word liberal? You know, elite liberal media, and that's what a lot of conservative critics say about public broadcasting. I mean, you give your opinions on your show. I mean, you are liberal. So is that, do you see that as a problem, calling public media liberal?
Well, I think that I think the right has been allowed to steal values and read their meaning into values. I think they have tainted words by besmirching them. I mean, most people in polls say they want the same kinds of things I want for our country. Does that make them liberal? I think that the most effective defamation that has occurred in America over the last 50 years has been the right wing's ability to make people wince when they hear the word liberal. But liberal, if it means Social Security, I'm for it. If it means public education, I'm for it. If it means protecting the environment, I'm for it. If that makes me liberal, it makes me liberal. But I still think of liberals as being open to the conversation of democracy and trying to be inclusive in our embrace of America. And I think we've got to take that word back and not run from it just because Rush Limbaugh and Hannity and Combs and Bill O'Reilly and others cast aspersions on it.
My guest is Bill Moyers. He has a new book collecting his speeches called Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Moyers, and he recently announced that he's going to be leaving his weekly public television series Now with Bill Moyers after the election. In the meantime, he has a new book called Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Times, that collects some of his speeches that he's given over the years. You were at the meeting in 1964 that led to the creation of public broadcasting. You write about this a little bit in your new book, Moyers on America. And this was in 1964 at the Office of Education to discuss the potential of educational TV, which became public broadcasting in 1967 after the passage of the Public Broadcasting Act. What do you remember of the mission as it was discussed in the proto-public broadcasting era back in 1964?
The Carnegie Commission put together a recommendation for what became the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. And we attended a meeting at the Office of the Education, the Commissioner of Education, to talk about it and to see what we could do about it. One of the last things I did at the White House before I left in January of 1967 was to hand that over to Douglas Cader, who was Special Assistant to the President for Education, and it became, as I say, the Public Broadcasting Act of 1967. The mission of public broadcasting was to create an alternative channel that would be free not only of commercials, but free of commercial values, a broadcasting system that would serve the life of the mind, that would encourage the imagination, that would sponsor the performing arts, documentaries, travel. It was to be an alternative to the commercial broadcasting at that time. Now, we only had three commercial networks at that time, ABC, CBS, and NBC. But they had made their peace with the little fantasies and lies of merchandising. And the Carnegie Commission and subsequently Lyndon Johnson, who signed that act, and members of Congress believed that there should be an independent alternative network that served served what the market would not serve. That was essentially its purpose. There are things in this country that the market will not provide: public education, public art, public schools, public broadcasting, public toilets. I mean, there are things that are not profitable, but that still serve a value. And I think the most important thing that we can do is to continue to treat Americans as citizens, not just consumers. If you look out and see an audience of consumers, you want to sell them something. If you look out and see an audience of citizens, you want to share something with them. And there is a difference. And I think public broadcasting, public radio, and public television have to be locked to the commitment to seeing America as a society of citizens, not as consumers. And somehow, if we accept that as our basic operative assumption, we'll find our way to serving that public in the years to come.
You allude to this in a couple of your speeches. You served as President Johnson's press secretary for 2 years. And you write in one of your speeches, you knew you wouldn't stay long, you couldn't stay long, because you can't serve two masters. What were the two masters you were thinking of?
The press and the president. I mean, my first 2 years in the White House, I was working on legislation and policy, the Civil Rights Act of 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, the Civil Rights Act of 66, and I loved that. The Public Broadcasting Act of 1967, the task forces that put together the basic plans for our legislative approach. I loved that. President Johnson went through one press secretary and then another, and then he asked me to become his press secretary. I said I didn't want to do it. He asked me a second time a few days later. I said again I didn't want to do it. 2 weeks later, he called me in and said he wanted me to do it. I tried to say no, but I couldn't, and my arm is still hurting, quite frankly, from trying to get out of that. But I flew home that afternoon to Dallas, where my wife was visiting her parents. And that evening, I remember saying to her as we retired for the night, well, this is the beginning of the end, because no man can serve two masters. I wanted to report to the press what the president was doing within the limits that I could, and I wanted to interpret the press to the president. I really felt my job was to be an honest broker, and yet that proved to be impossible to do. You have to take your side in that job. You can't be both things to both parties. And, you know, a president cannot allow the press to hustle his priorities. At the same time, the press is there as a proxy for the public.
Now, you served as press secretary to the president during the escalation of the war in Vietnam. What were some of the things that you and President Johnson most did not want the press to find out about?
Well, the president didn't want to disclose what might be the full cost of the war, the same thing that George W. Bush is going through.
When you're talking about cost, you mean financial cost?
Yeah, the financial cost, because he feared that he didn't think this would last very long, by the way. He thought that if he escalated the troops and made a real show of force, that Ho Chi Minh would back down, the leader of North Vietnam. I remember when the president gave a speech at Johns Hopkins University and proposed a vast Mekong Delta system for North Vietnam if, in fact, it would come to the peace table. He said to some of us at the White House later that night, you know, George Meany wouldn't turn that down. That is, the president had offered a bargaining chip, and George Meany, the head of the FFL-CIO, would accept that. He thought Ho Chi Minh would accept it. We did not understand the depths of Ho Chi Minh's commitment to the unification of Vietnam. But the president thought this would be over before too long, and that he didn't want to put a price tag on it, because if he anticipated it going a long time, the conservatives would use that to cut back the spending on the domestic programming that was so important to him. He also didn't want people to know when and where he was going to be making his moves, either militarily or diplomatically. That's understandable. It's why presidents shouldn't go to war unless it's a war of necessity, not a war of choice, because you can't fight a war in a democratic way without undermining the success of the war. And if you don't fight it in a democratic way, you undermine democracy itself. So, I mean, George W. Bush has made the same tragic miscalculation that Lyndon Johnson made in Vietnam. Iraq is not Vietnam. Iraq is a desert country. Vietnam was a jungle. Iraq is an urban society. Vietnam was not. But the rhetoric is the same. The optimism is the same. The belief that we can, with military force, achieve democratic ends is the same as it was in Vietnam. And that's why if you start a war on tragic, on flawed premises, you're going to have terrible things happen. And ultimately, you're going to come to grief.
Bill Moyers will be back in the second half of the show. His new book, Moyers on America, collects his speeches and commentaries. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Villa Incognito, a novel about imposters, lovers, and strange Japanese animals. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, how do we describe what went on in Abu Ghraib prison? Is it abuse, mistreatment, torture? Linguist Jeff Nunberg considers why it's hard to find the right word. Also, we continue our conversation with journalist Bill Moyers. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Bill Moyers. He has a new book collecting his speeches and commentaries called Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Times. He plans to leave his weekly PBS program Now with Bill Moyers after the presidential election. He turns 70 next month and says there are many things he wants to do that his series leaves no time for. He hopes to write a book about Lyndon Johnson. Moyers worked on domestic policy and legislation for LBJ and then served as President Johnson's press secretary from 1965 to 67. When you were press secretary during this period of the escalating war in Vietnam, and President Johnson did not want the press and the public to know what the full financial cost of the war was going to be, how did you try to prevent it from getting out?
Well, when I became press secretary, my father had a fourth grade education, a very honorable and humble man, sent me a telegram in which he said, tell the truth if you can, but if you can't tell the truth, don't tell a lie. And I tried never to tell a lie. I would more often than not say, you know, I can't answer that right now. I'll get back to you on that when I can. My job was to try to be responsive enough to satisfy the appetite to know, but not so responsive as to give away the whole thing.
You write about the Bush administration. Never has there been an administration so disciplined in secrecy, so precisely in lockstep in keeping information from the people at large and from their representatives in Congress. Do you say that with some admiration, since you're
some
saying
jealousy.
This, you're saying this as a former press secretary.
Some jealousy. You know, the two things inform my mature life when it comes to the passion I feel about journalism and openness. One was growing up a Southerner. I grew up in the Deep South that had suffered, as had the nation, from 250 years of denial about slavery. The South drove the free thinking preachers from the pulpit, the free-thinking editors from the newsrooms, and the free-thinking teachers from the classrooms. We paid, the nation paid, a terrible bloody price in a civil war. Then the South went into denial again. The nation went into denial again about the fact that what happened at Appomattox, which ended the war, had not been realized in peace. It took us another 100 years to fulfill the victory at Appomattox and to make that blood not shed in vain. Because we're in denial and not being truthful about slavery has marred this country's entire history. Then I did serve in the Johnson administration. I was in my late 20s. I had more energy than wisdom. And we drew the wagons around us. We didn't listen with enough openness to people who were defying official reality. We believed our intelligence. We believed our optimistic assessments. I believe Lyndon Johnson really believed that he could accomplish his goals there if we had enough time and enough luck. But we paid a terrible price, and the country paid a terrible price because we were wrong. And that's why I saw a play, maybe you saw it a few years ago, Tom Stoppard's play, Night and Day, in which a news photographer in there says, a news photographer character in Tony Stoppard's play says, people do terrible things to each other, but it's worse in places where they're kept in the dark. And I really do think that we need more openness, not more secrecy. This administration is incredibly successful at managing the flow of news up until the point at which the facts on the ground, the prisons, Fallujah, the casualties mounting, become impossible to ignore. Right down the line, most of what's happening in government, Terry, we don't know about. The Freedom of Information Act, which Lyndon Johnson signed, he didn't want to sign it. We had to drag him kicking and screaming to that signature. But once he signed it, he claimed it. This administration has been so effective at frustrating the efforts of journalists, historians, scholars, and ordinary people to get at the Freedom of Information Act. We are living in a closed society today.
Let me quote something else from one of the speeches in your new book, Moyers on Moyers. And again, this is referring back to the period when you were press secretary for President Johnson. You write, Iraq is not Vietnam, but war is war. Like the White House today, we didn't talk very much about what the war would cost. In the beginning, we weren't sure, and we didn't really want to know too soon anyway. We were afraid of what telling Congress and the public the true cost of the war would do to the rest of the budget, the money for education, poverty, medicine. In time, however, we had to figure it out and come clean. When and how did you come clean?
It was in the budget, I believe it was the budget process of 1967, when it became impossible to continue to spend on Vietnam and spend for the domestic priorities that were important to the president. And Kermit Gordon, the head of the budget bureau at that time, said, you got to pay for this one way or the other, either through deficit spending or through taxes. And that was when it hit the wall. That was when the president realized he could no longer hold out trying to put a price tag on the war. Even then he tried to. I left soon after that. I remember going over to the Defense Department, crossing the Potomac, going to see Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara. And I said, Mr. President, my responsibility is the domestic side of this, and look, here what the costs are going to be. Your responsibility is the Pentagon, the Defense Department. Here are the costs you've sent over. They don't add up. They add up to far more expenditures than we have revenues coming in. We need to ask for a tax increase. And Mr. McNamara, the Secretary of Defense, said, we can't do that, Bill. He said, if we go up to the Congress and ask for a tax increase to pay for the war in Vietnam and to pay for domestic spending, then the conservatives in Congress will cut off the spending for poverty, spending for education, the spending for Head Start. And if we aren't careful, then the liberals will vote against what we need in Vietnam. So he and the president worked out a budgeting system that continued to defer for a while the real cost. But in time, the deficit rose, inflation spiraled out of control, and the country was feeling the pain of that financial straitjacket. And that was when reality set in, and you couldn't hope or hide it any longer.
Let me quote again from one of your speeches collected in Moyers on America. And this is referring to Vietnam. The dead were coming back in such numbers that LBJ grew morose and sometimes took to bed with the covers pulled over his eyes as if he could avoid the ghosts of young men marching around in his head. Were those ghosts marching around your bed, too?
I was never at peace with the war, even when I believed that the people who were arguing for it believed in it. Do ghosts march in my head? No. Sadness reigns and melancholy at the lives that were lost that didn't need to be lost. That whole experience convinced me that war should be in self-defense and by necessity, not by choice. But the president was melancholy. He had a depressive streak in his nature anyway, and he took the keen responsibility of suffering psychologically and emotionally for all those lives, all those people. You know, when his two sons-in-law went to Vietnam, he would go with Lucy, his youngest daughter, to the little Catholic church she belonged to. 2 o'clock in the morning, she would go with him up there for him to seek some kind of solace. He was a torn man because of this. He was a true Cold Warrior. Remember, he was in the Senate in the 1950s at the height of the Cold War, and he did believe that in the doctrine of Munich, that if you didn't draw the line against an aggressor at a certain place, then you would have to fight that aggressor later on. He also believed in the credibility of his inheritance, that Eisenhower and Kennedy had said Vietnam was important and that it had happened on his watch, that he had to put meaning behind that evaluation. But the human cost of that became unbearable to him and a source of constant sadness and despair.
If you could briefly tell us, I don't know if you saw The Fog of War, the documentary about Robert McNamara, but
I did see it.
Yeah, I'd be really interested in a short version of your review of that film.
I didn't understand it. I thought it was more the work of the documentarian than it was a revelation about Robert McNamara. It confused me. There are two kinds of documentaries, and I've done hundreds over the years. One documentary is made, One documentary is found. You go out with your cameras and you insert yourself into a process and you try to capture the essence of it and come back and diligently edit it to reflect the essence of what you found. When you make a documentary, you go out with an idea in mind and you find the elements and compose it to fit that idea. Earl Morris had something in mind that he wanted to say about Robert McNamara. I did see in the documentary the same McNamara I knew many years ago, a man divided, a man troubled, a man still searching to reconcile what happened in Vietnam with his own values and to try to identify what was his place in it. But I was left confused and ambiguous when the documentary was over, and whatever its message was, I couldn't identify, and I didn't think it succeeded at that level.
My guest is Bill Moyers. He has a new book collecting his speeches called Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Bill Moyers. He has a new book collecting his speeches called Moyers on America. I want to ask you one more question about President Johnson. Johnson decided not to run again, I think because he felt so defeated by the anti-war movement and maybe over his head in Vietnam. Did he talk to you about that decision?
No, I had been gone well over a year by that. I left in January of 1967. He made that decision and announced it in March of 1968.
Mm-hmm.
I remember my wife and I were watching the speech, and I did not know up until the last minute what it was about. I did not know. I thought Lyndon Johnson would never voluntarily give up power. But I do know that he would talk often, even when I was there. Soon after the election of 1964, he would talk about the fact that he didn't think he'd live out his time. His father died an early death, and he thought that he was risking his heart and risking his health by being in the office. At the same time, he loved power. He'd sought power. He'd been denied power when he lost to Kennedy in 1960. And he just relished power until, as I say, it became clear to him that the use of power in Vietnam was not going to achieve its purpose, and it was going to come at a coming at a cost that he found unbearable. And I believe that he left because of that. I believe he left because he wasn't sure that he knew how to get us out of Vietnam, and that he hoped maybe somebody else would. But I was not there at that time, so I do not know what went into his personal thinking.
You mentioned that Johnson loved power. Do you think of yourself as loving power, and do you think of yourself as having spoken with or reported on many people or work with many people who do love power?
I don't love power. I don't dislike it, but I've never really had power. I had reflected power, reflected authority. I love government, and I love making things happen. The three best years of my life was when I helped organize the Peace Corps with Sergeant Shriver. I just wrote the foreword to the biography of Shriver. Those 3 years when we were making things happen, when we were releasing the idealism of Americans abroad, when we believed that we could have a beneficial and positive influence in the world, I love that. I love the first 2 years of the Johnson White House when we were passing the Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act, the Civil Rights Act of 66, and all of those. I like that. I really believe, as I said, I'm a liberal. I believe in public action for the public good, and I like that. But to have power for power's sake never has appealed to me. That's why I think I've never wanted to go into... I mean, I've thought about politics. Other people have suggested elected office. But I was offered the chief of staff's job in the Carter years, 1978, the mid part of his years. Bill Clinton offered me to ask me to come and be his chief of staff. I turned that down. Jimmy Carter asked me to become the first Secretary of Education. I turned that down. I turned those down because, having left government, I found in journalism the satisfaction of a work that I didn't want to leave. I really love journalism, and I believe journalism plays an important part in in it has a different kind of power. It's the power of shedding light on what's happening and to help people inform their decisions. And I've loved that for 32 years. I liked it when I went to work. My first job in journalism at the age of 16 was on the little newspaper in Marshall, Texas. I was just delighted in covering my hometown. Politics and government were a diversion for me, an unexpected, unintended consequence of circumstances and convergences in my life. But as soon as I could, I left and went back to journalism, and I've been doing it ever since, 1967. And I can't imagine having lived another life.
Do you watch the media that, of all different points of view, the mainstream media, the editorial media, the media on the right, the media on the left? There's, you know, lots of websites I'd include in there, too.
I do. I spend too much time soaking it up and absorbing it and following it, whether it's the websites on the right or the magazines on the right. I mean, I read 15 to 20 magazines every week across the spectrum, from Mother Jones to National Review. I've been reading National Review for 35 years. I get transcripts of Rush Limbaugh every day. At my office, Rush Limbaugh and Michael Savage and other the primary sources of right-wing radio. I read The Nation. I read In These Times. I read the National, the American Prospect. Yes, I probably take in too much information.
So every day you read a transcript of Rush Limbaugh's previous broadcast?
I make sure every week. I may not read it every day. I get every day's transcript.
Why do you want to read it?
Because I want to know what his audience is being told. I want to know what his audience is what's being said to them about politics, the environment. I mean, I do think you need to know, understand the milieu in which you're operating. And when my viewers come, I want to know what might have been playing on their mind and what they've been told elsewhere. But it's not just Limbaugh. I mean, Limbaugh, because he's the darling of talk radio. But there are a lot of others that I listen to. And I'm an inveterate scanner of the Internet. I think the Internet, the blogging, is the closest we've come in a long time to the history of the American media in the beginning, the American press. You know, in the 1820s, the 1830s, all you needed to be a journalist was to buy a press. That's why they call them ink-stained wretches, because they operated their own hand presses. And for a little bit of money, you know, like Tom Paine and others, you could have your own press. The first newspaper in America, public occurrences both foreign and domestic, published in 1619 in Boston by a man named Benjamin Harris, said his purpose was to end the spirit of lying in the land. The government, the colonial government, closed him down after one issue. Why? Because they said he didn't have an official license. Well, that's what the revolution was all about. And after the revolution, independent journalists, printers, they called themselves, sprung up all over the country. I think they were partisan, by the way. They took sides vociferously, attacked the other's politicians. But it was a healthy period of bombast in America in which people could sort out the information. I think the bloggers and the websites come close to that spirit of cacophony, to that democratic expression that we had in the early part of this country.
Well, Bill Moyers, we are just out of time. I want to thank you very much for talking with us. And I wish you good luck in your life after you leave your broadcast following the November elections. Good luck with the remainder of the shows, and good luck afterwards. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure and a joy to be in the same universe with you, the universe of public broadcasting. And I will have more time now to listen to Fresh Air than I have had in the past few years, but I've caught you often enough to deeply appreciate what you do.
Bill Moyers is the host of the public television series Now with Bill Moyers, which he will leave after the presidential election. He has a new book called Moyers on America, A Journalist and His Times. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg considers how to describe what happened at the Abu Ghraib prison. Mistreatment, abuse, torture? This is Fresh Air. We've all seen the same photos showing what went on in the Abu Ghraib prison, but we're using different words to describe it. Mistreatment, abuse, atrocities, torture. It's even been compared to a hazing. Our linguist Jeff Nunberg has these thoughts on why we're struggling to find the right words for what we've been seeing.
In a way, the photos from the Abu Ghraib prison speak for themselves. But it's hard to assign a moral significance to the acts unless we can attach a name to them. The French and Italian papers have been describing the affair under the running head, the torture scandal. And that's the word that's being used by the British papers on both the left and the right. The Red Cross report that was disclosed on Monday hedged that description only slightly when it described the treatment of detainees as tantamount to torture. The word torture has appeared in the American press, too. When The New Yorker ran a photo of a naked prisoner being threatened by dogs, it captioned it, "Torture of Iraqi Prisoners." And a few columnists called the events atrocities, which is somehow a lot stronger than saying that they're atrocious. But most Americans have been more circumspect than that. When Secretary Rumsfeld was asked about the charges of torture at his news briefing, he said, "I'm not going to address the torture word." And most American newspapers and news broadcasts have been sticking with generic terms like abuse and mistreatment. In fact, some people on the right have balked even at those words. In an opinion piece in the Los Angeles Times last Sunday, Midge Dechter referred to the treatment of detainees as a nasty hazing. And Rush Limbaugh described it as no different than what happens at a skull and bones initiation. "I'm talking about people having a good time," he said. "You ever hear of emotional release? You ever heard of the need to blow off some steam?" And here in San Francisco, I heard a pair of shock jocks the other day describing the prison as Abu Grabass and talking about the treatment in a way that made it sound like Animal House 3, Bluto in Baghdad. Strictly speaking, what took place in the prison probably does fit the Geneva Convention's definition of torture, which is pretty broad. It covers the infliction of physical or mental pain or suffering for any number of reasons. But people's choice of words here doesn't have a lot to do with what President Bush calls legalisms. The American media have other reasons for describing the events differently from the Europeans. They may want to extenuate the abuses, or at least avoid the criticisms they might get if they use what Rumsfeld calls the torture word. But it's also because torture and torturer don't seem quite the right words for what's going on in those photos. Torture may be familiar in the modern world, but it's also remote. The only torturers we see up close are the ones in the movies. It suggests an aestheticized ritual, the Bach playing in the background during the torture scenes in Battle of Algiers. And the word torturer brings to mind a cosmopolitan, usually foreign figure whose cruelty is ironically counterpoised by a polished, even effete manner. Laurence Olivier in Marathon Man, Gert Frobe in Goldfinger, or the Muhammad Khan character in Lives of a Bengal Lancer telling Gary Cooper, "We have ways of making men talk." Or you think of Vincent Price in Almost Anything, not foreign exactly, but astringent, urbane, and talking like somebody who's lived most of his life abroad. There are no middle-class, middle-American torturers in our gallery, much less torturers with the pudding countenances of those GIs who were working at McDonald's just a year ago. And the humiliations they were inflicting didn't have much in common with the rituals of pain and submission that the word torture brings to mind. They went down another road, even if it fell off just as sharply. That's what creates the sense of incongruity we feel when we see these photos, I think. The actions may have been far from Delta House hijinks, but you wouldn't know it from the clowning poses the GIs were striking. In an odd way, in fact, Dechter and Limbaugh have got it right despite themselves. Not that there's any defense for describing this as hazing. That's a deeply dishonest word for what went on. The prisoners weren't in a position to resign from the club, and they weren't about to be given membership pins when Pledge Week was over. You may as well say that the L.A. police were hazing Rodney King. But if the word hazing was chosen to palliate the offenses, it also makes them seem more familiar. Hazing's the sort of thing that any adolescent with a normal libido might be capable of, and worse if the circumstances permit. As the Stanford psychologist Phil Zimbardo showed in a famous experiment more than 30 years ago, it doesn't take a lot to transform a group of healthy, intelligent male college students into sadistic prison guards, provided somebody in authority gives them the nod. It's striking that we don't really have a good word for this sort of thing. Not that it isn't right to call it abuse or mistreatment, but those are vague words that blur the moral distinctions we're trying to capture. And we may yet find out that the behavior extended to the sorts of fingernail-pulling barbarities that not even Rumsfeld would have any qualms about describing as torture. But while words like torture and atrocity are well-suited to convey the alien inhumanity of the decapitation video that surfaced this week, they don't really help us to grasp the disturbing familiarity of the faces in the pictures from Abu Ghraib, the kind of cruelty that isn't inhuman, but all too.
Jeff Nunberg is a Stanford linguist and author of the new book, Going Nuclear. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Patty Leswing, Ian Chillog, and Jessica Chu. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with the 1979 hit, Ain't No Stoppin' Us Now. John Whitehead was shot to death on Tuesday. He sang on the record and co-wrote the song with Gene McFadden. McFadden and Whitehead also co-wrote the songs Backstabbers and For the Love of Money.
So many things that's held us down, but now it looks like things are finally coming around. I know we've got a long, long way to go, and where we'll end up, I don't know. But we won't let nothing hold us back. We're putting our show together, we're polishing up our act. And if you've ever been held down before, I know you refuse to be held down anymore. Don't you let nothing, nothing stand in your way. I want you to listen, listen to every word I say, every word I say.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. From Barnes & Noble, now featuring My Soul Looks Back in Wonder, Voices of the Civil Rights Experience by Juan Williams, available at Barnes & Noble stores and at bn.com. By audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. audible.com/freshair. From TIAA Craft, offering financial solutions to people in education as well as investors nationwide. TIAA-CREF.org. And by Wiley, publishers of The Halliburton Agenda, The Politics of Oil and Money, Dan Brydy's investigation into the company with connections to Dick Cheney and the United States military. Available wherever books are sold. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Always look on the bright side of life.
Monty Python's Life of Brian, the biblical satire about Brian Cohn, who was born one stable over from Jesus and gets mistaken for him, is back in theaters. The movie was first released 25 years ago. On the next Fresh Air, we hear from members of Monty Python. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
When you're feeling in the dumps,